and multiple terrorist attacks in European cities, Europe's policymakers began to press for more military spending. Even amid these new pressures, however, as of 2012, Asia had displaced Europe as the number two military spender. Important fact. At present, there is no such thing as a standing, full-spectrum European armed forces, let alone a European Space Command. There's the European Defense Agency, which describes itself as a catalyst, promoting collaborations, launching new initiatives, introducing better defense capabilities. There's the Common Security and Defense Policy, which stresses peacekeeping, conflict prevention, and crisis management. There's the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, with its three-sided view of security: political, military, economic, environmental, and human. There are the individual militaries and gendarmeries of the European Union's member states and the United Nations' frequent multinational efforts at peacekeeping. None of these is a permanent warfighting machine. Even less war-oriented are the EU's space-related agencies. The 20-plus member European Space Agency, the European Organization for the Exploitation of Meteorological Satellites, the European Global Navigation Satellite System Agency, and the European Union Satellite Center. Other than its multinational rapid response battle groups, intended for crisis management rather than all-out war, the European Union's closest approach to a conventional military force is NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Though the territory it defends now stretches from the western shores of Canada and the United States to the eastern border of Turkey, far indeed from the North Atlantic, its name persists. Article 5 of its founding treaty, signed in 1949, declares that an attack against one member is an attack against all. This is the principle of collective defense, invoked for the first time in NATO's history following the terrorist attacks of 9/11. NATO has also intervened in conflicts between and within non-member states, such as the Bosnian War, the Kosovo War, and the Libyan Civil War. But NATO has no explicit space policy and no integrated space command. Should there be another Article 5 attack, the only space assets NATO could muster would be the space assets of its member states. And what Europe could presently contribute consists mainly of remote sensing, commercial communications, and data from weather and scientific satellites, along with Galileo and Galileo's comrade, EGNOS, the European Geostationary Navigation Overlay Service, which augments GPS signals over Europe. Surveillance is something Europe could contribute, but any battle-ready spacecraft would have to come from the United States, whose 45th president did not merely express displeasure at the substantial level of U.S. funding for NATO, but also early on pronounced the organization obsolete. The non-martiality of European space policy matches that of overall European security and defense policy. Space Strategy for Europe, a European Commission plan adopted in late 2016, stresses that space technologies contribute to economic competitiveness, assistance to refugees, climate monitoring, and sustainable management of natural resources. The role of space in security and defense is presented as a side benefit, useful for addressing the increase in people fleeing their home countries and the consequent demand for increased border controls and maritime surveillance. Other named threats and risks include the proliferation of space debris, the effects of sun-driven space weather on satellites and ground-level infrastructure, cyber sabotage of space assets, and the increase in space actors and space objects. Here, the term situational awareness refers to space debris, not battle plans. Overall, Europe embraces a characteristically internationalist approach. Space power must be shared power. But the focus continually returns to economics. Space strategy for Europe pegs the EU's space sector, including manufacturing and ancillary services, at more than 20% of the total global value, and while the EU is now third globally in military spending, it remains second globally in public space spending, with a projected 7-year space budget of 12 billion euros. Not that the military dimension is absent. The Space Strategy Plan describes Europe's Earth Observation and Global Navigation Satellite programs as purely civilian programs entirely under civilian control. But that isn't the full picture. Services and data generated by those programs can, by request of an individual member state, be made available for emergency services, crisis management, border management, peacekeeping, and police operations. And the EU's other space capabilities can provide additional operational capacity for the implementation of the common security and defense policy, notably with regard to precision navigation, Galileo, surveillance, Copernicus, communications, GovSatCom, autonomous access to space, launchers, and situational awareness, SST, and can contribute to European strategic autonomy and non-dependence. Space and defense technologies are also closely interlinked. Sounds not too different from the U.S. Air Force's declared power to conscript NASA or Google or even a foreign entity's satellite assets and data when needed. The biggest difference might be that in post-conquistador, post-Holocaust Western Europe, defense sounds more peaceable than defense does in America. Compared with the EU's Galileo and Copernicus, the European Space Agency may be a less likely conscript for crisis management or peacekeeping. ESA's stated foreground issues are innovation, inspiration, and industry, not migration or terrorism. Science is fundamental to every ESA endeavor. Safety and security are auxiliary, mentioned only in connection with the need for European space scientists to pursue their work unimpeded by threats, whether from orbital debris or cyber sabotage. Glance at the press releases and web pages produced for ESA's triennial policy meeting of space ministers in December 2016, and you won't find the word military. What you will find, repeated with variations, is simply the wish to pursue economic betterment and scientific enlightenment for all. A straight comparison between Europe's and America's official visions of space power in the 21st century reveals two partners with divergent agendas. But ask European and American astrophysicists about their agendas, and what you'll hear will strongly converge. Space power, or some military commentators prefer to write it, space power, moved to the front lines of warfighting in early 1991. For 43 days between January 17th and February 28th, more than 80,000 tons of bombs were dropped on the formerly thriving fourth largest military power in the world, the oil-endowed but heavily indebted nation of Iraq, which half a year earlier had invaded its small, still-thriving, also oil-endowed neighbor and unyielding creditor, Kuwait, and had refused to leave despite a string of condemnatory UN resolutions. It was the first major U.S. air war since Vietnam, and the first major conflict following what then appeared to be the end of the Cold War. It was the world's first satellite war, Arthur C. Clarke, the coming out party for space support, Everett C. Doleman. The U.S. military, which had dropped most of the bombs, repeatedly called it the world's First Space War. Never before had a military force been so dependent on Earth-orbiting satellites for extensive support of its war effort. Strategy, tactics, planning, communications, identification of targets, weapons guidance, troop movements, navigation, long-range weather prediction. Satellites reshaped them all, while also providing early warning of Iraqi missile launches and, of course, live TV coverage. Starting in the late 1980s, components of the military's own advanced space systems had been called into action for mission planning in Libya, minesweeping in the Persian Gulf, communications and weather updates in Panama. But not until the first Gulf War did the huge military potential of such systems become evident. In the words of a U.S. Space Command assessment issued in early 1992, space systems supported every aspect of planning, control, and execution of the war with Iraq. Or in the words of a retired Royal Navy Rear Admiral and a retired Royal Air Force Captain, it was the first real test under war conditions of the $200 billion U.S. space machine. A tangled web of factors instigated the Gulf War and its consequences. The national boundaries of Iraq had largely been drawn by the League of Nations in the early 20th century when the Ottoman Empire was dismantled and Iraq, resentful at having been nearly cut off from the Persian Gulf, had thrice claimed Kuwait as a proper part of its territory and campaigned for its annexation. The United States had, since the late 1970s, treated Saddam Hussein's Iraq as a favored partner against Iran, ignoring his regime's use of chemical weapons and giving Iraq tens of billions of dollars worth of armaments on credit. Now Iraq's oil revenues were crashing while Kuwait was helping to keep world oil prices low through its own overproduction. America's demand for an uninterrupted supply of low-priced oil was an unspoken but key motivator for its attack on Iraq. The American-led coalition forces' intensive 1991 bombing of Iraq's telecommunications infrastructure, power plants, water treatment facilities, government ministries, bridges, roads, airfields, ammunition depots, petroleum refineries, food processing factories, retreating soldiers, and civilians shopping at markets turned out to be the prologue to the later, fuller U.S. destruction of Iraq as a modern nation. Here, however, our concern is the ascendancy of the satellite as enabler of war. All kinds of war, from assaults waged by the armies, navies, air forces, and cyber forces of nation-states, to the scattershot terrorist acts of an individual propagandized through the internet and in possession of a mobile phone. GPS. The U.S. Air Force's Navistar Global Positioning System was a prominent innovation of America's prosecution of the Gulf War. Today's GPS is 24/7, real-time, accurate, and precise down to a few meters. With input from widely available augmentation systems, those few meters can become a few centimeters. GPS is now absolutely ho-hum for most users. But back in 1991, it was an extraordinary idea that American soldiers, whose commanders had seen many more jungles than deserts, would be able to navigate the blowing sands of Kuwait, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia with the help of orbital assets that included just 16 participating satellites of the planned constellation of 24 that could provide longitude, latitude, and elevation data for about 19 hours a day, and that yielded measurements accurate to 15 meters at best, but infinitely better than a paper map could offer. Ground troops could even traverse regions that would challenge seasoned Iraqi navigators. GPS also assisted pilots. For the initial airstrikes on Iraqi radar installations, for instance, Pavlo helicopters, equipped with GPS, partnered with Apache helicopters, equipped with old-style Doppler radar. The Pavlos led the way and pinpointed the targets, which the Apaches then attacked with Hellfire missiles. Even non-stealthy B-52 bombers equipped with GPS could enter the theater shielded by electronic silence. Early on January 17, 1991, seven B-52G Stratofortresses, described as flying bomb trucks by one aviation source, flew nonstop from Louisiana to Iraq, where they launched 35 GPS-equipped cruise missiles at key parts of the communications infrastructure, destroying most of their targets. GPS-equipped Air Force F-117A Nighthawks, the first stealthy plane ever used in combat, delivered laser-guided, semi-smart bombs at an average hit rate of 50%. When fully functional, GPS has three components. One, a minimum of 21 orbiting satellites, plus at least three spares, all of which continuously signal their ever-changing position and the atomic time at that position. Two, the individual receivers, which automatically calculate their own position based on the signals they pick up from multiple satellites in different positions. And three, the ground control network of monitoring stations and antennas, which manage the satellites' flight paths and atomic clocks. The satellites occupy six different orbital planes in medium Earth orbit at an altitude of about 20,000 kilometers. The signals are sent as radio waves and, as with radar, can be distorted by the electrically charged ionosphere through which they must pass on their way down to Earth's surface. To establish its position in longitude, latitude, elevation, and time, a receiver must detect signals from at least four different satellites. If you exclude elevation, it needs just three. The extensive sky coverage of today's GPS constellation enables receivers to pick up ample signals for all commercial and military applications. It would not be unfair to call Gulf War vintage GPS rudimentary. Six of the 16 satellites were old R&D units pressed into wartime service. One of the 16 had malfunctioned 2 months earlier. Also, as GPS signals made their way down to Earth's surface, they were susceptible to jamming. Then there was the problem of the receivers, specifically that there weren't enough of them. At the start of the war, the stockpile was negligible. In 1989, GPS had an encrypted military channel with an accuracy of about 15 meters, and an unencrypted civilian channel with 1/6 the accuracy. But receivers capable of using the military channel were in short supply, causing not only the Pentagon, but also the soldiers' family members to order thousands of portable commercial receivers for America's sons on the open market. This, in turn, forced the Pentagon to switch off the encryption, making the now insecure military channel accessible to all. By the end of the war, some 4,500 commercial and 850 military receivers had been officially deployed to the U.S. forces, plus all those unofficially supplied by loved ones, still far too few to serve the hundreds of naval vessels, the 1,600 combat aircraft, the 40,000 tanks, armored vehicles, and heavy artillery, and the 500,000 U.S. troops. The paucity of receivers had grave consequences. As a recent Air Force news story stated, after the Gulf War, the U.S. Army announced it would install GPS receivers in all armored vehicles to help minimize fratricide, which became a major source of casualties in Desert Storm, most often caused by armored unit commanders lost in the featureless Iraqi desert or out of position during ground attacks. This was boom time for manufacturers of GPS receivers. Non-military sales had already doubled year over year as hikers, boaters, pilots, and land surveyors learned of the device, which had moved past the experimental stage only at the very end of 1988. Initially, military sales accounted for only one-fifth of the foremost U.S. manufacturers' total revenues. But as soon as Iraq invaded Kuwait, the Department of Defense ordered some 8,000 lightweight receivers from just that one company, a sale of more than $40 million, an amount that exceeded its total 1989 revenues. Suddenly, the factory was running three shifts a day to meet demand. Despite its limitations, the Gulf War's GPS turned time-honored methods of navigation into an arcane, archaic craft and forever changed the planning and prosecution of war. Early commentators were blown away by its transformative power. Writing for the New York Times in 1988, at the dawn of the GPS era, science and war journalist Malcolm Brown evoked the momentousness of the neonate satellite constellation in a piece titled, "New Space Beacons Replace the Compass." To the captain of a clipper ship, a pocket-sized gadget linked to artificial beacons in the sky that could infallibly guide a traveler to any point on Earth might have seemed as remote from reality as a winged horse. But next year, anyone with a few thousand dollars will be able to buy just such a magic navigator. For the Defense Department, the completion of the Global Positioning System will be a milestone. Guided by the system, a missile traveling to the opposite side of the world could hit within a few dozen feet of its target, Pentagon officials say. The system could infallibly lead an assault team through trackless jungle to an enemy stronghold, a bomber to a single enemy building, or a boat to a gap in a dangerous shoal. Without landmarks, sextant, star almanac, dividers, or the other paraphernalia of conventional navigation, the user of a portable GPS receiver can effortlessly read off the direction and exact distance along a great circle of any of 50 destinations stored in its memory. A glance at the gadget's liquid crystal display also tells the traveler his own latitude and longitude to within 100 feet, his speed and course over the ground, and the probable time of arrival at his destination. Brown's exuberant prose harkens back to the accounts of those who waxed poetic at the power and joy of using the first navigational compass, the first spyglass, the first seaworthy chronometer. Greater momentousness was soon to come, when a GPS precision guidance package would be integrated into smart bombs and not just be part of the bomber aircraft's navigation system. But in the mid-1990s, when Gulf War-era laser-guided weapons were still the last word in precision, and GPS-guided gizmos, such as the Joint Direct Attack Munition, JDAM, a conversion kit for smartening dumb bombs, and the Joint's standoff weapon, JSOW, a winged air-to-surface actual weapon, were not yet readily available, military theorist Colin Gray felt it useful to note the obvious. Systems that gather and provide information do not themselves fight the enemy. Ultra-intelligence in World War II, whose potency as an enabling influence is beyond question, did not in itself sink any submarines or destroy any aircraft, although it did empower tactical combat units to do those things. The Navstar Global Positioning System, GPS, permits economies of force in mission planning, but Navstar itself can put no weapons on target. It is not always obvious where space power begins and ends, when information from satellites augments the potency of naval, air, and terrestrial military operations. By the late 1990s, the full-scale GPS system was up and running, ready to direct the first generations of JDAM and JSOW, plus an updated GPS-endowed model of the Army Tactical Missile System. Do these developments weaken Gray's contention that GPS could not put a weapon on a target? No, he might answer. Technology is always ancillary to strategy. Back in 1988, Malcolm Brown's sources had told him that handheld GPS receivers would start being issued to American soldiers in 1992, and that the first to get them would probably be Special Forces units. While GPS wasn't ready in time for the coalition's invasion of Iraq in January 1991, it was definitely ready by March 2003 when a now mainly U.S. and British invasion force overwhelmed the country a second time. The reasons, according to President George W. Bush, were to disarm it, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger, and to remove an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass murder. In 1995, the system had achieved its full complement of 24 satellites. By 2003, there were 28. In 2000, the practice known as selective availability, the intentional degradation of publicly available GPS signals, implemented for reasons of national security, had been terminated. For a while, at least, everyone, civilian or military, would always and everywhere have access to the same degree of accuracy. During the 2003 invasion, in fact, precision improved from just over 15 meters to just over 2 meters. That improvement came from updating every satellite's navigation package each time the satellite began to rise above the horizon of the battle zone. Errors that accumulated over time, such as ionospheric distortion and relativity effects, were driven to zero for a period of time, enthused one of the space ops commanders who carried out war support long distance from the 50th Space Wing's Operations Center at Schriever Air Force Base in Colorado. We hit them all a half hour before satellites came into theater and created this sweet spot over Iraq of less than 4 meters precision. Today, GPS comprises 31 operational satellites plus a few that are decommissioned but still orbiting, ready for reactivation if needed. The 12 oldest ones were launched between 1997 and 2004. The 12 newest between 2010 and 2016. Next generation GPS 3 is waiting in the wings, the first two satellites to be launched by SpaceX. Now that the practice of degrading the signals available to civilian users has been discontinued, GPS transmits on several different frequencies that require different access codes, some of which are strictly or partially military. As essential a public good as roadways and running water, basic GPS nonetheless remains an Air Force program, funded primarily through the Department of Defense, with modest input from the Department of Transportation. In itself, that management and funding arrangement shows how militarily indispensable the system has become since its debut in Iraq. Although the first, GPS is no longer the only global positioning system, and the names for the system itself are multiplying, two recent acronyms being PNT, Position Navigation Timing, and GNSS, Global Navigation Satellite Systems. China has nearly completed its own version, Beidou, while the European Union's Galileo is well on its way. For some years, however, the most important one has been Russia's GLONASS. As with GPS, its full complement is 24 satellites. After becoming fully operational in 1995, the same year as GPS, it languished for several years as some of its satellites ceased operating and were not replaced until President Putin prioritized the system during the first decade of the 21st century. Available only to the military until 2007, GLONASS is now a more or less joint operation of the Ministry of Defense and the space agency Roscosmos. Whereas GPS, as of spring 2017, had 31 satellites slotted into six orbital planes, GLONASS had 27, launched between 2006 and 2014, slotted into three planes, just slightly nearer Earth's surface and inclined at a different angle to the equator, an angle that makes GLONASS more effective than GPS at higher latitudes, where so much of Russia is located. Moscow, for instance, sits farther north than the northernmost point of the contiguous United States. Today, many international smartphones use both GPS and GLONASS for greater coverage. Russia, in fact, has mandated that all its state and security apps use the dual system, although such a mandate could be dropped in response to a deteriorating political climate. But as the head of GLONASS said in 2014, the capability to receive and process signals from both systems increases not only the speed at which coordinates are processed, but also their reliability, from 60% to 70% to practically 100% for ordinary urban conditions. Pointing out how dependency on a single system makes users vulnerable to denial or interruption of service, he argued that no individual country should unilaterally control infrastructure so crucial to every country and every economy. The operator of the navigation system has the option of either switching off the civilian signal for a specific area or of desensitizing it artificially. This is not even about military conflict, as the threat of turning off the navigation switch can in itself be used to achieve political or economic aims. Therefore, it is just a small step from a technological dependence on a narrow satellite navigation field to economic, political, and military dependence. In other words, the deterrent power of threat must be circumvented by the power of independence, which is an important reason for the global proliferation of separate global positioning systems, though interdependence can have its own deterrent power. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, dubbed the Pentagon's brain by its chronicler Annie Jacobson, is taking independence one big step further. Having already funded the miniaturization of GPS receivers, DARPA has lately been funding the development of battery-powered, chip-scale atomic clocks that could function even in the absence of a satellite connection. Physicist Robert Lutwak, the program manager for this effort called ACES, Atomic Clock with Enhanced Stability, notes that precise timing is essential not only for the Department of Defense, but also for the infrastructure of everyday civilian necessities such as banking and electrical power distribution. Reducing reliance on signals from satellite-based navigation systems is key to improving resilience. The European Space Agency, too, has an ACES project, except that in this case the acronym stands for Atomic Clock Ensemble in Space, and its material incarnation is a large, peace-loving payload carried on the International Space Station, not a small object sized to fit in a warfighter's pack or pocket. Its main agenda is scientific inquiry into the fundamental laws of physics, not the facilitation of battle planning or banking. But at the heart of both versions of ACES is the atomic clock, a mechanism that tracks the passage of time by registering the frequency of light emitted by a specific quantum leap, a transition of electrons within the atoms of a chosen element. Currently, the second is defined as exactly 9,192,631,770 cycles of the light emitted from such a transition within the cesium-133 atom. It's easily replicable in the laboratories that need it, so scientists the world over can be sure their measured second is consistent with everybody else's measured second. For now, though, the world relies on satellite-dependent global positioning systems, which have already transformed how billions of people and things navigate their appointed or chosen paths. For better or worse, GPS and its relatives have made countless inventions possible, from America's Predator and Reaper warrior drones, to Dubai's single-passenger, driverless air taxis, to the management of crops via precision farming. So, unless you hope to recreate the conjectural voyage of Polynesians to Peru 1,000 years ago, you need never again consult a map or compass, let alone an astrolabe or camel. Whether you're in Moscow or Manhattan, rural Rajasthan or central Shanghai, global positioning will direct you to your destination, assuming you don't mind having your whereabouts tracked by eyes in the sky. Ease of navigation through sand and cloud was only one of the benefits that Gulf War space assets supplied to Western warfighters. Swift communication, both long-haul and intra-theater, was another. General Colin Powell, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the Gulf War and later George W. Bush's Secretary of State, maintained that satellites were the most important factor in building the command, control, and communication network for Operation Desert Shield. From a British military point of view, satellites brought the coalition's supreme commander within a telephone call of the White House, Downing Street, and the Élysée Palace. Not every channel on every communications satellite used during the war could be made available to the coalition forces. So to maximize capacity, communications satellites were drawn from many sources, including the U.S. Defense Satellite Communication System, the U.S. Navy's Fleet Satellite Communication System, the U.S. Air Force's Satellite Data System, NATO, and the British Skynet System. Also commandeered were several one-of-a-kind U.S. military and experimental satellites, as well as leased assets from the likes of AT&T, Bell, Sprint, and especially the International Telecommunications Satellite Organization, Intelsat, and the International Maritime Satellite Organization, Inmarsat. A pioneering constellation called Tracking and Data Relay Satellite System, TDRSS, operated by NASA and intended to support communication with spacecraft in orbit, was also called upon. The satellites were not all tuned to the same frequency. The network was cumbersome and complicated. As the ground forces advanced, hundreds of satellite ground terminals had to move with them. Because of the diversity of hardware and the multiplicity of controlling agencies, the parts didn't always work well as a whole. The system could be overwhelmed when communications conveyed not just words, but images, which consume high bandwidth. Yet despite the many problems, all those satellites at the military's disposal accelerated the pace of command during the 100-hour ground war. Information could now pass rapidly from battlefield to tactical commanders and onward to the strategists. The benefits of those communications satellites accrued to television networks too, and thus to the public at large. CNN became the go-to place for war news. Home TV reached the troops, while TV viewers at home could watch the skies of Baghdad erupting. Besides facilitating communication, satellites also provided early warning of Iraq's nighttime Scud missile launches against U.S. allies Israel and Saudi Arabia. Three Defense Support Program satellites continuously scanned the skies for bright splashes of infrared, indicating the heat of a rocket plume. The DSP satellites relayed their data to U.S. Space Command in Colorado, which would immediately confirm whether a given plume came from a Scud launch, and if so, would predict the impact zone and then rush the analysis via satellite, of course, to Central Command in Saudi Arabia. By that time, the missile would have been airborne for about 5 minutes, traveling at thousands of miles per hour toward its target, leaving at most 2 minutes for Central Command to issue a warning and for its recipients to take action. Another group of satellites provided crucial data on weather. They warned of increased risk of a sudden sandstorm, determined wind direction, important for predicting the spread of any chemical agents, assessed dense coastal fogs that could drastically reduce visibility, monitored midday conditions in remote deserts that could presage evening thunderstorms, dust storms, or sandstorms, and tracked the dark smoke plumes from any of the hundreds of Kuwaiti oil wells deliberately ignited by the Iraqis. Coalition forces needed to know of any weather that could compromise weapons systems or force commanders to cancel air attacks. Hence the reliance on weather satellites, not only from U.S. military, Defense Meteorological Satellite Program, and non-military sources, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, but also from the European Space Agency, Japan, and Russia. Weather imagery was so important, states Conduct of the Persian Gulf War, the Pentagon's exhaustive final report to Congress, that the Joint Force Air Component Commander in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, kept a light table next to his desk to review the latest DMSP data, and the Tactical Air Command Center didn't finalize the daily air tasking order until after they'd received the most up-to-date DMSP images. Out in the field, though, DMSP weather reports were harder to access. The U.S. Army dealt with the problem by buying German commercial receivers, which supplied data directly from civilian weather satellites passing above the Middle East, while the U.S. Air Force dealt with it by faxing DMSP images to the field via landline, which slowed down the flow of information. But again, as with GPS, the weather satellites offered key input that was otherwise unavailable to the warfighter in 1991. Sky conditions during the entire Gulf War were the cloudiest they'd been in more than a decade, and updates on cloudiness affected daily tactical decisions. Clouds could interfere with the laser beams used to illuminate targets, causing laser-guided bombs to lose guidance. Suddenly too cloudy? Scrap today's LGBs. Clouds could also cause a switch in targets, which is what happened because of the changes in cloud cover visible in two satellite images taken on the same January day, less than 2 hours apart. One showed a clearing of cloudy skies over Baghdad. The other showed sunny skies in Al-Basra beginning to cloud over. Now for the spy satellites. Another major enabler of the 1991 assault was the mountain of information, maps, photographs, multispectral images made possible by the many surveillance, photo reconnaissance, and remote sensing satellites that had been scrutinizing Earth's terrain from afar for decades. Their purposes varied, but their yield was uniformly useful. Millions of dollars worth of images purchased from commercial remote sensing satellites helped to track Iraqi troops, select targets, plan amphibious operations, execute aerial bombing campaigns, and establish land access routes for coalition ground forces entering from the deserts of Saudi Arabia in the final 100 hours of the war. Today, nobody has to be informed that Earth observation satellites can, as a 1992 U.S. Space Command assessment phrased it, show what is hidden from normal view. But back then, a decade before the release of Google Earth, that was still a capability worth celebrating. During the Gulf War, wide-field images supplied by commercial remote sensing satellites, both American Landsat and French Spot, provided information on the overall lay of the land, substantial changes in terrain compared with previous images, open areas suitable for helicopter drops, and large-scale movement of troops or materiel. Landsat images showed features in both the optical and infrared bands of the spectrum, and they came only in color, with a resolution of 98 feet at best, about the size of a blue whale. Spot data came in either color or black and white and offered better resolution, 33 feet for the black and white, for making detailed maps. Arms control specialists say those levels of resolution are fine for overall planning, but insufficient to identify a military ground unit, which requires resolution of about 15 feet, much less a tank, which requires about 3 feet. Narrow field, higher resolution spotlight images, useful for planning and executing strikes against specific targets and in assessing bomb damage, came from America's Keyhole Photo Reconnaissance Satellites, the KH-11, and the Advanced KH-11, both equipped with CCD technology, and from the La Crosse Cloud Penetrating Radar Imaging Satellite, which in 1991 was the sole spacecraft undeterred by bad weather 24/7. Russian and Japanese satellites also provided multispectral high-res images to the coalition's war effort. In early August 1990, when U.S. military forces first deployed to the region, their maps of Kuwait, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia were between 10 and 30 years old enough to make them undependable. Using then-current Landsat data, the Defense Mapping Agency produced an initial batch of updated maps by early September. At that point, Saudi airfields were little more than runways in the sand. So, Landsat imagery was converted into the engineering drawings used to build huge modern airbases. Also, whenever and wherever the ground was disturbed by troop movements, road building, a jeep's path over sand or grass, that disturbance would show up as a change in reflectivity when compared with an earlier image of the same locale. When two scenes are flashed quickly back and forth, as was done with two Landsat images of the Kuwaiti-Saudi border, the first taken in August 1990 and the other in December 1990, most of what's there remains the same, making it possible to readily identify the site of any changes. This technique, pioneered by astrophysicists using analog photographs in the early 20th century, was readily adapted to digital imagery in modern times, with a computer instead of a human reviewing the differences between images. It's a simple yet potent means to discover changes from one moment in time to another. Astrophysical discoveries generated by such comparisons include fleeting supernovas in the distant universe, Barnard's star, the fastest moving star seen in Earth's sky, Pluto, the first object found in what would later be called the Kuiper Belt, salty water oozing down the inner wall of an impact crater on Mars, and the rapid movement of stars at the center of the Milky Way, suggesting the presence of an otherwise undetected supermassive black hole. A few months after the end of Desert Storm, the French Minister of Defense declared, "Without Allied intelligence in the war, we would have been almost blind." At that point, Europe had not a single military spy satellite, only France's remote sensing Spot. America, by contrast, as described by British military space advocates in the winter of 1991, had a multi-purpose space armada with a massive supporting processing and communications chain. No comparison. America had put heavy resources into military space. Europe hadn't. By the beginning of the next engagement in Iraq in March 2003, the U.S. Space Armada was even more massive. Lessons learned from shortfalls and screw-ups in Desert Storm had catalyzed the creative squads at military space corporations, military laboratories, and military research agencies, and had accelerated work already underway. Their varied efforts during the next decade were aimed at better connectivity, greater numbers of smaller, lighter, tactical satellites to support commanders in the field, ultraviolet sensors for military surveillance spacecraft, increased numbers and carrying capacity of small communications spacecraft, better GPS with better ground antennas and direct input to precision-guided weapons, computer networks that could fuse input from multiple sensors, electric propulsion for the transfer of high-mass payloads to geosynchronous orbit without resorting to huge rocket stages, lightweight solar arrays, a standard all-purpose basic space bus to which mission-specific hardware would be attached the way a warhead attaches to a rocket, an experimental satellite to test autonomous navigation systems, infrared tunnel sensors that would be thousands of times more sensitive than piezoelectric sensors, supercomputers, a radiation-hardened, super-high-speed integrated circuit chip set. All these and more were in the works by the spring of 1991, just months after the end of the first Gulf War. As Aviation Week and Space Technology noted at the time, the development of advanced military space technology for future defense and intelligence satellites continues to grow despite pressures on the U.S. defense budget. The 1991 budget for the Air Force's new Phillips Laboratory was more than $600 million, while the budget of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, was $187 million. Set to jump the following year to $290 million. Money was flowing. Miltech was soaring. NASA's budget was way larger, yes, almost $14 billion. But dual-use tech was a meaningful share of that. Furthermore, as a 1992 task force on U.S. space policy stressed, there are not two space industrial bases, one for defense and one for the civil space program. They both draw from the same well. They largely use the same industry, require virtual identical technologies, share the human skills, often use common facilities, and certainly draw new entrants from the same academic institutions. Preserving the base for one helps the other, and vice versa. It's no wonder the multi-trillion-dollar Iraq War started off in 2003 on a better space technology footing than had its predecessor, although it might be more correct to say a better space operations footing. The intervening dozen years had yielded many technology upgrades. The GPS system now had its full complement of satellites. Most cruise missiles were now GPS-guided. Crucial satellite data could now be transmitted directly to users, bypassing a time-consuming layer of analysts. At least one of the multiple surveillance satellites would now image the battlefield every 2 to 3 hours while passing overhead. Even if you had continuous video taken by a strategically positioned geostationary satellite, it couldn't match the resolution of an ordinary surveillance satellite orbiting 100 times closer to the ground. Plus, there were now many more and more capacious satellite ground terminals with 6 times the bandwidth as before, and enough lightweight GPS receivers to supply the land forces with at least 1 per 9-person squad. But in speaking to Aviation Week and Space Technology, shortly after the end of Operation Iraqi Freedom, the first 26 days of the 2003 invasion, the senior military space officer at the Combined Air Operations Center in Saudi Arabia emphasized the organizational, not simply the technological improvements. Our whole intent was to bring an integrated effect to the battle space. It's not space for space's sake. It's space integrated with everything else to produce effects in the kill chain. Addressing the House Armed Services Committee at about the same time, Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz agreed. Our approach to OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, reflected the concept of the battle space, replacing the concept of the battlefield. On previous battlefields, we massed forces and achieved jointness by deconflicting rather than integrating forces and conducted relatively symmetrical attrition warfare. In this joint air, land, sea battle space, which also includes space and the electromagnetic spectrum, we massed information and knowledge, used smaller formations that employed both lethal and non-lethal force in rapid and asymmetric ways, and conducted effects-based operations directed by flexible, dynamic command and control relationships. This synergistic battle space makes each of our military service members more powerful in the effects they can achieve and confers greater protection from the enemy. There's more than a little salesmanship in those paragraphs. Bravado aside, the interval between Desert Storm and Iraqi Freedom did raise U.S. commanders' comfort level with space capabilities, which translated into even greater speed of information processing and even more rapid communication at all levels of the campaign. To help carry out Iraqi Freedom's approach to warfighting, 33,000 space-savvy support personnel were dispersed across the joint services and throughout the area of operations at 21 U.S. and 15 foreign sites. The combination of all those people and all that technology yielded unprecedented overall results. As summed up minus the hyperbole by Anthony H. Cordesman, a senior national security analyst, this was the first large-scale war in which the United States could fight with 24-hour continuing intelligence, satellite, and sensor coverage over the battlefield, as well as the first major conflict where it could take advantage of full 24-hour coverage by the Global Positioning Satellite, GPS, system. The United States and Britain did not have total dominance of space. Iraq had access to satellites for television transmittal, had purchased large amounts of satellite photography before the war, and it could make commercial use of the Global Positioning Satellite System. The coalition had so great a superiority in every area of space, however, that Iraq's capabilities were trivial in comparison. The range of space-based communications and sensor assets, and the vast bandwidth the United States could bring to managing global military operations, allowed it to achieve near real-time command and control and intelligence collection, processing, and dissemination. At the same time, GPS allowed U.S. and British forces to locate friendly and enemy forces and both target and guide weapons. Did America's increased space power benefit the 25 million Iraqis left leaderless by the fall of Baghdad and the capture of President Saddam Hussein in April 2003? In the end, the second U.S.-led rapid assault on Iraq, followed by year upon year of every kind of violence, ripped the country apart. The victory, proclaimed in the spring and summer of 2003 by so many U.S. officials and commentators, and the government in a box ready to roll in, touted by one U.S. commanding general, were delusions. Cordesman cautions in the opening paragraph of his 2003 book, The Iraq War, Strategy, Tactics, and Military Lessons, "History is filled with efforts to make instant judgments about the lessons of war that ultimately prove to be based on false information and assumptions." He cannot bring himself to refer to the war's end or the declared peace without alerting his readers to the falsity, even the hubris, of using those words, and so he encloses them in scare quotes. The cost of the fighting since the, quote, end, unquote, of the war, the, quote, peace, unquote, that has followed. He warns that U.S. operations did not succeed in reducing violence and that the scale of the fighting might well broaden. Cordesman's warning has come true. America's shock and awe campaign gave way to the disintegration of modern Iraq, the renewal of sectarian conflicts, and the emergence of regional jihadi armies. Even today, in parts of the country, going to the market for a kilo of rice can be a gamble with death, and going to school an impossibility. In the wake of the war, aside from the role of reconnaissance and remote sensing satellites in detecting the hidden presence of ancient ruins and the looting of ancient sites, America's formidable space assets did little to improve the lives of the people of Iraq. As for America's forthcoming wars, they will be waged with even more formidable space assets, fewer ground troops, more autonomous aerial vehicles, more nimble satellites and drones, more remote control, more cyber sabotage, and less blanket physical destruction. Space power and cyber power will produce less messy, less bloody results, which will also be less dangerous to those who impose them. Relying on satellite data to pinpoint the presence of purported or actual enemies, such as Osama bin Laden, and to obliterate them and their associates, or at least their families and neighbors, will become ever more commonplace. Video gaming, the destruction of a building, will become ever easier and ever more removed from the torments of the battle space.